This is The Takeaway for Friday, September 22nd, 2017.
I declare open the 70th regular session of the General Assembly.
Military hysteria is not just an impasse, it's a disaster.
I call on all nuclear weapon states and
countries.
There is
still hope for peace, and we must not give up.
If Russia wants to restore its role as a credible actor in resolving the situation,
we do not ask for a blank check.
We want to streamline access into our system.
By violating its international commitments, the new U.S. administration only destroys its
All of our hearts are with the people of Puerto Rico.
As Iran's regime seeks the destruction of Israel, Iran will face no fiercer enemy.
A solid, robust, and verifiable agreement with Iran.
We must be far more robust in identifying these ideologies and defeating them.
The potential of the United States in terms of what it's done has been wonderful.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's great to have you with us on this Friday. Well, you've seen the speeches and the harsh rhetoric between the United States and North Korea. All this week, leaders and diplomats at the United Nations General Assembly have heard it all. 193 countries are represented, and while the speeches matter, often what goes on behind the scenes matters a lot more. So what else are UN delegates talking about besides President Trump's America First speech on Tuesday? And more important, what are they doing at the UN? For that, you have to go to the sideline meetings, to the receptions, and even to the parties to pick up what delegates are saying. And that's what Mark Leon Goldberg does. Mark is the editor of UN Dispatch and host of the Global Dispatches podcast, and he's been at the General Assembly all week long. Mark, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's do start with President Trump's speech before the UN, because there was a lot there. His threat to destroy North Korea, calling the Iran deal an embarrassment, its emphasis on nationalism. So delegates have had the rest of the week to digest this speech from the leader of the United States. What are they saying?
Interestingly enough, delegates are sort of dismissing Donald Trump in the same way that they've been dismissing his tweets on the subject as something that is sort of a bombast that they could have expected. But the policy substance behind the bombast is still somewhat unclear. I mean, it is true that it was an extremely bellicose speech from the president of the United States. We've never had a president deliver a speech from the UN podium threatening to wipe out another country. You know, this is a podium typically used to promote global solutions to global problems, not threaten the destruction of a whole other country.
Now, what about the response? North Korean leader Kim Jong-un issued a statement yesterday full of bombast, essentially saying he would discipline Donald Trump with fire.
And this is the same dynamic that you've seen play out over Twitter and in public statements. It just, I think, is a little more alarming and dramatic because the UN General Assembly is the backdrop to this back and forth between Kim and Trump.
Well, I mentioned just before the Iran deal, I want to play you a piece of sound from Federica Mogherini, the High Representative of the EU for Foreign Affairs, talking about the importance of the Iran deal.
The nuclear deal is working. We already have one nuclear crisis. One nuclear crisis is already enough.
Mark Leon Goldberg, is there a sense among delegates that the Iran nuclear deal could actually be in danger? President Trump called it an embarrassment, as I said, and he also said that he thought it was likely to change.
You know, it's hard to imagine the Iran deal remaining in its current form, given what President Trump said from the podium. I mean, it's hard to kind of walk back the words that he spoke in front of the UN General Assembly, you know, trashing the Iran deal and suggesting that it would be something different. You know, it's one thing if you say these things on the campaign trail, they can kind of be dismissed as domestic politicking. But he said this from the podium of the UN General Assembly directly to other world leaders. However, it seems that in meetings this week, actually undoing the Iran deal and walking away for it is likely harder than Donald Trump thinks. There was a key meeting at the Security Council among members of the Iran deal coalition, the Security Council, Iran, and a few other countries. And it seems as if the U.S. delegation is not getting other countries on board with this idea that the Iran deal was more than the nuclear issue, that it was about warming improving relationships between the U.S. and Iran and having Iran do more to counter terrorism. That was not what the Iran deal was about. The Iran deal was very strictly focused on nuclear issues, and it seems that U.S. diplomats are unable to convince their European and other Security Council partners otherwise.
Well, nevertheless, the American administration is not happy with that deal, and you can't really draw a line between the United States and Iran without making a triangle that intersects with Israel. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave a pretty stark speech in front of the UN, telling the UN General Assembly that it was not reacting to Iran's threats to destroy it. Listen.
Those who threaten us with annihilation put themselves in mortal peril.
A counter threat from Netanyahu there, Mark Leon Goldberg. More of the same from Netanyahu or real warnings?
I think it's likely more of the same. What has changed for Netanyahu is that his domestic political situation is far more imperiled now than it ever has been in any other time of his over decade in office. I mean, he is under very real legal trouble in Israel, and that comes with a lot of political headaches. And so, this speech has to be seen in that domestic political context in which he is an extremely embattled politician.
Sure. And it was a bit remarkable, Mark, that we didn't hear much about Syria all week. Is that still important on the UN's agenda, or is it just being overshadowed by threats from North Korea?
It was totally overshadowed this year. You know, in years past, Syria has been the dominant, global crisis du jour around which the international community has typically tried to make some progress during UN week, whether that's boosting funding for the humanitarian side of things, trying to pay for more food and tents and shelter for Syrian refugees, or on the political side of things, trying to come together for around new rounds of peace talks. That was totally absent this year. I'd say that the crisis of the moment that garnered most delegates' attention was the crisis on the border of Myanmar and Bangladesh, where you have now over 400,000 Rohingya refugees coming across the border, facing what the UN officials have called, what Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called, a campaign of ethnic cleansing committed by the government of Myanmar against this religious and ethnic minority. And that is something that the humanitarians at the UN have been trying to call attention to. You know, I spoke to one member of the UN Refugee Agency who has been at this job for decades, and she said that this crisis on the border of Bangladesh and Myanmar is unlike anything she had ever seen in her long, long tenure at the UN Refugee Agency. So it's something that has been on the UN's agenda in recent weeks and did inform part of the conversation at the UN this week.
So bring us behind the scenes of the General Assembly this week a little bit, Mark. We can cover the speeches. We watch the speeches. We're talking about the top line stuff. But what are delegates talking about among themselves that we're not hearing?
So it doesn't get covered too much in these contexts, but the sustainable development goals are a topic of a lot of substantive conversations, both inside the UN building and also in meetings around New York this week. These are a set of 17 goals, the top line of which is to totally eradicate extreme poverty by 2030, as defined as people who live as under 125 a day, to be achieved by from 2015 to 2030. So the Sustainable Development Goals, the Global Goals for Sustainable Development, were a topic of much conversation this week, all centered around devising specific solutions to very discrete and tangible problems around the world, like maternal mortality or ending hunger or reducing our carbon footprint. Around town this week, there were just a number of forums and meetings and launches of new partnerships to take on parts of this really, these urgent kind of global threats. And though it didn't make headlines, this was the real substance behind the scenes of what was happening at UN Week, having different groups come together around these really important global issues.
Mark, we're going to let you go, and there are lots of serious issues that have been covered at the UN and that you and I have been discussing. Let's leave it on a positive note if we can. I know there are dozens, hundreds of receptions, parties, thousands of delegates, and every year there's one good joke circulating among world leaders. What is it this year?
Well, it must be President Trump's invention of a new country in Africa called Nambia. at a reception for African leaders. He gave a toast mentioning this invented country. Presumably, a combination of Namibia and Zambia have come together to form this brave new country called Namibia.
Namibia's health system is increasingly self-sufficient.
And what are delegates saying about Namibia?
Oh, they are wondering where it's located. They're chuckling about it. It was not the most serious of things, but it does sort of demonstrate a general disregard of Africa and the African continent by the U.S. president, which is unfortunately a true thing in international diplomacy.
Mark Leon Goldberg, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Leon Goldberg is editor of UN Dispatch and host of the Global Dispatches podcast. Well, climate change and the Paris Climate Accords have gotten a lot of play at the UN General Assembly this week. But our next guest was at the General Assembly, too. And he says we don't have our priorities straight when it comes to dealing with climate change on the global stage.
Look, global warming is a real problem. But because we tend to get over-worried about specific areas, we end up under-investing in where we can actually help. And we end up spending money on things that'll do virtually no good, neither for climate or for all the other troubles that we're focused on.
That's Bjorn Lomborg, the controversial president of the Copenhagen Consensus Center.
Certainly, much of the news that I see, and certainly if you look at a lot of sort of the easy news, it's either, oh no, it's not happening at all, or we should do something about global warming and, you know, Harvey or anything else. If you remember that famous cover from Bloomberg after Sandy, it's global warming, stupid. And it suggests that that is what we should do. You know, cutting carbon emissions is the way to help future victims of Sandy and Irma. And the honest answer is, if you want to help these people, it's much more about building resilient structures.
Lomborg is president of the Copenhagen Consensus Center. It's a think tank that focuses on development aid. And in the world of climate change, Lomborg is controversial. Lomborg is the author of several books, including The Skeptical Environmentalist. He says climate change is real and a threat, but he argues that people are losing their perspective on what can and should be done about it.
The biggest conversation that we have right now is hurricanes, right? And for a very obvious reason, there are lots in the season. And so the long-term prediction from climate change is that we will see slightly stronger, possibly slightly fewer hurricanes. And therefore, there is a real concern that we'll probably see higher impacts in total. But the argument then to say, oh, so we should cut CO2 to help future victims of Harveys and Irmas and all the other names is a very bad one, because we know what is really causing most of the damage is the fact that we don't have good zoning, that we subsidize insurance to have people build irresponsibly. We don't have good levees. We don't have good plains where you can get rid of the water fast. There are many, many simple things that you can do that would do much, much more good. So again, my point is not that climate change is not a real issue, but it is to say let's focus on the things that will actually help. And specifically for hurricanes, there's much, much better policies that also are much cheaper and will act much faster.
I don't know. I've seen a lot of people on other news shows, and people have come on this show talking about wildfires in the West, right? Something that's much more attributable to temperature increases, hotter, longer fire season, hotter fires, more damage. And most of those people talk about the way we build and the way we do forest policy. They don't necessarily say CO2 equals fire, but it is all part of a piece, isn't it?
And that's wonderful. Because then, you know, we're all on the same wavelength. But then, of course, we get back to saying, so what should we do about global warming in general?
Right.
And there, my concern is, you know, if you look at pretty much anyone who talks about climate change, they'll go to, you know, the grand promises from the Paris Agreement or the precursor for that, the Kyoto Agreement. These are the things that are being sold as if they're going to solve climate change, or at least are a significant piece of the puzzle. But the reality is Kyoto ended up doing virtually zero. Paris Agreement, if everyone does everything they promise, it will cut about 1% of what we need to cut by 2030 to get to 2 degrees target. So it effectively leaves 99% of the problem unaddressed and at a fairly high cost. So we're talking $1 to $2 trillion in global GDP loss. So that's a lot of money to solve almost none of the problem. And that's why I'm arguing again, let's focus on smart solutions, namely invest dramatically more in research and development into green energy. If we can get green energy to be cheaper than fossil fuels everyone will switch. If we can't, we'll probably never fix this problem.
Why are they two separate things, though? I mean, one of the virtues among those who support Paris is that you put the rules into the game. The United States and China within Paris agree to 26% cuts. Isn't that the way that the Bill Gateses and the Bjorn Lombergs of the world then come along and say, I have the way that we can get to big carbon cuts. We can invest more in clean energy. One is the rules of the game and one is the equipment you use.
Well, it would be nice if that was the case, but I actually think if you look at it, these measures have never really driven anything. They do drive something in the EU, but they only drive essential subsidies and often very inefficient subsidies. The fundamental point is you're not going to drive a dramatic innovation by saying, well, we promised 26%, so we better get our gear together and put our thinking hats. If you want innovation, you should fund innovation. And if innovation comes, and there's no reason to believe that we're not smart enough to actually figure this out, then we don't need the targets. So the targets are much, much less effective. I'm not going to say they're zero, but they're very close to zero impact.
Now, let's talk about the real world, though, and about politics when it interacts with climate change. I watched you testify against the Paris Climate Accords in the House of Representatives a year or two ago. And there's no question about it that your testimony and your argument on these issues is used by political forces as an argument for doing nothing, or at least a go-slow approach, or at least an unnuanced view that little or no action is appropriate here. That's the real world, Bjorn Lomberg. You know that you're used that way.
Oh, I'm in no doubt that if you make an argument where you say, look, the current way we do things is stupid, let's do it smarter, the people who just don't want to do anything will just listen to the first part. And what are you going to do? I mean, it's still true to say that's a very poor use of resources, and we need to listen to that. Just like many other people who wants us to do action would be saying, oh, even Bjorn Lomborg says we should do something. We should do these smart things on R&D and so on. So the fundamental point is, if I tell the whole truth, I'm not really responsible for the fact that some people just don't want to do anything.
I hate to call it alarmism, but without the urgency and without targets of some kind, where's the motivation then for the massive investments? Even if the Bill Gateses of the world say there's an economic argument here, there might be a disconnect between the type of urgency that the climate change story brings and the need for Bill Gateses and Warren Buffetts and governments to say, we're going to invest.
Well, I love that question. And it allows me also to take one more step back, because remember, climate change is not the only issue that the world is facing. Actually, there are tons of different issues that the world is facing. And if we weren't sitting in a well-nourished part of the world, we would be worrying about our kids dying from easily curable infectious diseases and not getting education, not even having enough food.
Right. Except, as you know, climate change can be easily connected to food, certainly to jobs, certainly to water, no question. Education, maybe you can make an argument.
Look, there's no doubt that you can couple climate to these issues, but of course you can also go the other way and say, if you're better educated, if you have jobs, if you're not hungry, you're going to be much less vulnerable to climate and to everything else. The solutions to those problems are also much cheaper and much more effective. The OECD is now making estimates. We spent about $140 billion in development aid for the world, and that's a good, not all of it goes well and all that stuff, but fundamentally it's a good indicator of how we care about the rest of the world. The OECD tracks how much of that goes to climate. It used to be zero, but now about a quarter of all development aid goes to climate projects. And that's basically because we are so focused on saying we want to help the world with climate that we forget that the rest of the world is very clearly telling, no, please actually save my child.
Bjorn Lomborg is president of the Copenhagen Consensus Center. Great to have you here.
Good to be here.
He can't hear were the shouts of neighbors on Tuesday night in Oklahoma City as police officers approached a deaf man standing outside his home and holding a metal pipe. A neighbor from across the street who asked to remain anonymous told News OK.
And that's when I yelled out, he's deaf. And right after I yelled out that he was deaf, it was bang, bang, bang. I mean, it was just the instant I said that, just right after that, it was bang, bang, bang.
At the receiving end of that gunfire was 35-year-old Magdiel Sanchez, a deaf man who neighbors say regularly carried a pipe to fend off stray dogs around the neighborhood. Sanchez died in that shooting. It's the fifth officer-involved shooting in the city so far this year. Storm Jones is a reporter with KGOU Radio in Oklahoma City, and he's been covering the story.
So we know it all began with a hit-and-run investigation in Oklahoma City Tuesday night. Police were able to track down the vehicle involved that fled the scene, and they found it in front of Magdiel Sanchez's home. When they got there, he was sitting on the front porch. An officer immediately called for backup when they identified the vehicle. Police say whenever officers approached the man sitting on the front porch, he got up with what they described as a weapon in his hand. We know that's a 2-foot-long pipe. He began approaching officers. At this time, witnesses say they're telling the police, who have their guns drawn, one has a gun, one has a taser. They're telling police he's deaf, he can't hear you, please don't shoot. The neighbor told me about 6 people were yelling this at the police officers. But they say Mr. Sanchez keeps advancing towards them. One police officer fires his taser, and the other fires his gun, with Mr. Sanchez about 15 feet away. Witnesses have varying accounts which fired first or if they fired simultaneously. Mr. Sanchez's neighbor also tells me that he heard more than 6 gunshots before the event was over.
So Mr. Sanchez had this pipe, which, as I mentioned, neighbors say he carried around the neighborhood all the time. But was there any indication that he was threatening with it as he was carrying it?
Police say he was using it as a weapon, so they saw it definitely as a threatening object. But like you said, the neighbors say he never left the house without it. It's just kind of a tool that he used to communicate, whether it was tapping on something or using it kind of to demonstrate things.
What are the police saying about this shooting so far?
The police are saying it was just a breakdown of communication. Mr. Sanchez's father, who was the driver of the vehicle, was in the front yard as well that evening, but he didn't speak any English. So Mr. Sanchez, being nonverbal and deaf, and his father not speaking any English, the police really described this as a breakdown of communication. And Police Chief Bill City yesterday said even if the police officers knew the man was deaf, he doesn't know that that would have changed anything, because he described it as a quick, rapidly evolving situation where the officers just had to react.
So as I mentioned, Storm Jones, this is the fifth officer-involved shooting in Oklahoma City this year. What's the community saying about that number and about their unanswered questions about this shooting in particular?
I've talked to members of the Latino community. They say they're skeptical of police interactions, really. Police Chief Bill City has gone out into the community, but they say it's just hard for them to be trusting in the police in this political climate. The deaf community, they also are skeptical. Back in 2014, a similar incident happened in Oklahoma with a 64-year-old African-American man who was stopped after a hit-and-run accident. And when the Oklahoma Highway Patrol caught up with him, he reached for a placard he carries that says, "Driver is deaf." And the police thought he was grabbing for a weapon. And so he was taken out of his car forcefully and ended up with his eyes being swollen closed and charged with resisting arrest. The Oklahoma deaf community says the Highway Patrol learned after that incident, and they're hopeful the Oklahoma City Police Department will learn after this one. They just hate that it takes an incident like this for additional training to be implemented.
Storm Jones, reporter with KGOU in Oklahoma City. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We go to Mexico City now, where rescue efforts continue following the 7.1 magnitude earthquake that struck on Tuesday. The death toll is now past 200, including 19 children who died when a primary school collapsed. In just a minute, we'll take a closer look at the vulnerable infrastructure in schools across Mexico and across much of the rest of the world, too. Meanwhile, in Mexico City, volunteers from neighborhood after neighborhood have been working feverishly to help their fellow citizens, including one group called Los Topos, born out of the devastation of the earthquake in Mexico City in 1985. Maya Croth is a freelance journalist based in Mexico City, and she joins me now. Maya, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Ted.
Well, you've been out in the streets and in the neighborhoods during the recovery efforts. What have you been seeing on this fourth day after the earthquake?
A lot of outpouring of support from just average everyday Mexicans who have been coming down to donation centers, bringing medicine and all kinds of supplies, but going so far as putting on a hard hat and work boots and picking up a pickaxe and going into the disaster sites. I think that's one of the most interesting things about the scene here is how much the civilian segment of the population is involved in the response.
Now, there's one particular group in Mexico City who's been responding here that a lot of people probably haven't heard of. They're called Los Topos, and you got some sound of some of the volunteers near some of the different sites talking about Los Topos. Listen.
We are very proud of every Mexican who's doing their part to help. The Topos are a great example of people helping out and not expecting anything in return. They're volunteers, and if we have extra time, we can help them. They go where no one else can, and they've rescued a lot of people. Sometimes you can't even see anything in the rubble, just a bit of a nose or a hand, and if it weren't for the Topos, a lot of people wouldn't be here.
Who are Los Topos?
Los Topos is a name that's applied to a group, maybe about six or seven different groups that are all largely civilian groups that are nonprofit. They're not associated with the government. And the fact that they're completely volunteer makes them heroes to a lot of people here in Mexico. They're among the first responders to earthquake disasters, not only in Mexico, but around the world. And they grew out of something that happened after the big quake of 1985 here in Mexico, where a public housing project in a neighborhood called Tlatelolco collapsed, and neighbors grew really frustrated with the slow response on the part of the authorities and just started to go in themselves, go into the rubble and see if they could save anybody and see what they could find. And in the 32 years since, they've grown into kind of an elite civilian force. They have extensive training. They've developed methods for rescuing people that I think may be unique in the world of search and rescue, mostly involving building tunnels and finding people that way. In fact, their name translates to mole in Spanish. So topos means moles.
The moles.
Yeah, and they burrow into places that other people can't get to.
Well, you were out in the neighborhoods and you spoke to Liana Maria Barrera, who really reflected the admiration that people have for Los Topos.
I thank God that there are people who are that brave to offer their lives because they are in danger too. These people are risking their lives to save a brother, and that is priceless.
Maya Croft, you also mentioned, though, that Los Topos came out of frustration with the government and with the response after 1985. What are people seeing today when they look at the government response, when they look at their president, Enrique Peña Nieto?
In general, the response I've seen on social media and on the ground is not super positive. And I don't think that's unusual. This is not a very popular president. You do see a large presence of different federal agencies, government agencies, military, and for the most part, they are keeping things calm and orderly. But we are also hearing reports here and there that the collaboration with civilian forces like the Topos is not going as smoothly as some might hope.
Maya Croft is a freelance journalist in Mexico City. Maya, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Todd.
Among the worst tragedies, 19 children and 6 teachers died when a primary school collapsed in Mexico City's southern Coapa district. All across the world, schools can be especially vulnerable in earthquakes. The 2005 earthquake in Pakistan destroyed 7,000 schools. And in 2008, more than 5,000 students were killed after a 7.9 magnitude quake struck the Sichuan province in China. Janice Rogers spends a lot of her time trying to figure out why schools can be so vulnerable to collapse in earthquake zones, sometimes even more vulnerable than the buildings around them. Rogers is chief operating officer of Geohazards International. That's a group working to limit losses when earthquakes strike.
Sometimes schools are more vulnerable than other buildings, and sometimes they're less vulnerable, and that depends on the construction type. But if buildings are the same type, schools have certain features that can make them more vulnerable to collapse. Those include larger rooms and other configuration patterns that are unique to schools, like large windows that often have columns next to them that can be damaged in earthquakes.
What other features do schools typically have that can make them more vulnerable?
older schools in particular were not designed to modern earthquake-resistant codes, and this makes them vulnerable. And this is true in many places around the world. We see new schools being built well with earthquake-resistant design, but the older schools that predate those codes would be vulnerable. And there are also, in many cases, schools have been built with materials that we know perform poorly in earthquakes. For example, unreinforced masonry. That could be brick, it could be stone, but those types of schools have performed poorly in past earthquakes.
Is that largely because in many places that are short on resources, when governments or neighborhoods build a school, they build it as cheaply as possible?
That can happen. Masonry is frequently locally available, but it also had to do with the people not understanding the hazard. Many, many years ago when schools were constructed. There are many unreinforced masonry schools that existed in California, for example, prior to the 1933 Long Beach earthquake, which occurred early in the morning, but led to the damage and collapse of many, many schools in that area. So in that case, that was just how they built schools until they discovered, unfortunately, that that type of building doesn't do well in earthquakes.
So that was in the 30s in California. But where in the world is this most a problem with schools built either improperly or with unreinforced materials?
There are a lot of places where there are a large number of unsafe school buildings, certainly in South Asia where we work. There are many, many schools that are older and that are vulnerable. That's one area, but it's not alone. We also work in Haiti, where there are many vulnerable schools, and there are a number of other countries around the world with vulnerable schools. And of course, we still have vulnerable schools here in the United States.
Is there any way to know how many schools here in the States might be vulnerable? You have to be near a fault line or an earthquake zone, of course, and not built to code, I guess.
Right. And there have been efforts to determine the number of vulnerable schools in a number of states with appreciable earthquake hazard. And first, a typical way this is done is by looking at how old the schools are and what type of building they are. Again, unreinforced masonry is a type that would immediately raise concerns, as well as reinforced concrete buildings that are older than the certain age when modern codes came into force.
So do states or counties or jurisdictions typically check for this kind of thing, or is it a case where they wait for tragedy to strike?
I think many states have been proactive, and there have been programs at state level, for example, in Oregon. Also, there's been work in Utah, in Alaska, in Washington, and also certainly at the school district level. A lot of this work is done locally, and it can be motivated by parents that are concerned about the safety of their children's schools.
Still, Janice Rogers, it's one thing for parents or communities in the United States or Canada to demand retrofitting of schools where their communities may have those resources. Around the world where communities don't have those resources, what does it take to make a school quake resistant if it isn't already? What can be done?
Well, there are a number of lower cost seismic retrofit strategies. An example would be in Nepal. We worked with a local nonprofit organization in Nepal called the National Society for Earthquake Technology. And as part of our project back in the late 1990s, they retrofitted the first school in Nepal. And since then, they've gone on to retrofit more than 300. And the vast majority of those schools did very, very well in the 2015 earthquake. And the techniques that were used were lower cost, could be accomplished with some government funding or outside agency funding, and a lot of community participation, community donation of labor and of materials. And so it was affordable to do. And there are now many more schools being retrofitted in Nepal.
And do you generally find when you go to a community and warn of schools that could be vulnerable to collapse that those communities listen? I mean, I ask it because so often it seems like countries, communities don't react until tragedy has already struck.
What we found in our practice is that schools are just one of the most motivating things. People care about their children's safety, and they're more willing to invest in a school than they would be in even their own home.
Janice Rogers of Geohazards International, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. This Wednesday marked the start of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. And that means that Jewish families everywhere came together to eat, to pray, and to yell at each other.
Sweetheart, that... Wait. Sweetheart, this is too big. How much did you pay for all of this?
It was $1,000.
Oh, stop.
That's some of the typical chaos in the Pfefferman family in the hit Amazon show Transparent. The show specializes in the ultra-realistic comedies and the tragedies of the Pfeffermans. But the real focus of the series is Mara, played by Jeffrey Tambor. She's a trans woman who started transitioning in season 1, and since then the show has dealt with Mara's transition and how it's affected Mara's biological kids and her non-biological family too.
We call it chosen family. I think that's true of a lot of queer people, a lot of people in the LGBTQIA tribe, is that we adopt and we are adopted.
That was Alexandra Billings, who plays Davina on Transparent. The 4th season of the show premieres today on Amazon. So I sat down with Billings, also with Trace Lizette, who plays Shay, and with Jill Soloway, the creator of Transparent. Soloway says the show taps into a long tradition of Jewish neurotic humor, but with an important twist.
I did grow up watching, you know, Woody Allen and Albert Brooks. And of course, I love Larry David. But what I love about Transparent is that it actually has that kind of Jewish neurotic thing, but from a female and a trans-centered protagonist. We don't really get to see that a lot with women, and we never get to see that with trans folk and with queer people, that they can be in that protagonist place of being the schlubby, lovable, overthinky losers. So besides the fact that we're kind of readdressing things and looking at things that Woody Allen did, having them come from a place of women or trans people or gender nonconforming people feels really revolutionary to me.
Talk about the gilded cage, though, of Transparent and what it means for you as actors. By any measure, you've had enormous success on Jill's show. You're making some money. America is seeing you. They love your performance. And yet, can you play a woman on another show? Can you play a trans person on another show? Is any other type of show that isn't about trans people going to be interested in hiring you?
Well, I love Transparent. I feel like I'm spoiled. But going forward, I really want to get back to playing cis roles. I always want to play trans as well. But more than anything, I just want to be working.
I think for me, it's less about worrying about whether or not I'm going to go to another show or do a play, and more about what are the stories that are the cause of this cracking that the Soloway family has been at the heart of. And the world in and of itself, especially our country, is split wide open now because we're in the center of a government that is focused less on diversity and more on dividedness. So for me, I don't see this as a gilded cage. I see this as a prairie, as a great big huge open field that I'm running through. The skills that and the gifts that I collect from these human beings. I was just talking to Trace about this. Trace has a scene. It's a scene in a dressing room in this new season. This couple of minutes is a peek into the trans world that no cis person ever gets. And Trace's performance is so specific because she's not afraid to bring her entire life experience into this work. And by her doing that, I get to stand by and bear witness to someone surviving that. So the next thing that I go do, whether it's a commercial for dog food or whether it's a Broadway play, I remember that that's possible.
So let's talk about this show then at this moment in America. Jill, Transparent never would have been made 15 years ago. Nobody ever would have considered it, let's be honest. It's made now, it's a hit, and it's popular. But this is happening at the very moment in this country with bathroom bills in North Carolina and Texas and other places that are discriminatory against trans people, where the president of the United States is banning transgender people from the military, people willing to fight in the military. Put these two things together for me. There is a culture that is willing to watch, celebrate, and love Transparent at the same time as a huge part of the political culture is pushing back on this as hard as they can.
I do think it's all connected. You know, I'm always saying the words women, people of color, queer people as quickly as possible as one phrase. It's a way of saying other with a capital O. What they all have in common is that we are now separated and otherized by the people who consider themselves quote unquote normal, or the people who consider themselves the people who have access. And let's call that white cis males of a certain class. So what Trump does is equal opportunity, other everybody all day long, looking for ways to trigger people into that feeling of fear. I'm afraid of trans people. I'm afraid of women's power. I'm afraid of people of color. Trump is triggering people's fear. They're psychologically otherizing other people. He distracts us by doing the same thing that Hitler did when Hitler said that, you know, the Jews can't be in the Olympics. Why? Well, because they're Jews. They're not people. By saying trans people can't be in the military, Trump is doing something much bigger than sending out this tweet to excite people. Trump is saying that trans people aren't human beings.
Trace, when you started your career as an actress, did you envision yourself being part of all of this? I mean, all of this politics at the national level, under the spotlight of a national conversation and a huge national debate. Let's face it, a lot of people wouldn't like you if they saw Transparent and saw what you represented. Do you want to be part of that, or do you just want to be a Hollywood actress who's successful?
Initially, I just wanted to be an actor. I had been performing in some form or fashion since I was a teen, as a young drag queen in Ohio, working in the bars of Dayton and Columbus. And then a few series of events, one of them being the death of Elon Nettles in Harlem, who was murdered and died a block from my house, was a big wake-up call for me, along with seeing my sister, who was a longtime friend, Laverne Cox, live her truth out loud and proud on Orange is the New Black, all kind of shifted my awareness in myself and the prison that I was living in, of the prison of passability, the prison of trying to be quote unquote normal. And up until that point, it had been wrapped up in my shell and tactics of survival that I'd been taught by my trans elders to kind of get through and survive. It'd been, you know, the tools I'd been given was, you know, this is your resource, your body, and this is what you use to get through. Eventually I got past that, and it's been wonderful. It's been painful, but it's also been, you know, great to find my true self.
Alexandra, what does this moment mean for you, being part of this show that is really on the cutting edge of a national debate?
It's quite extraordinary, because when I transitioned, it was about 10 years after Stonewall. So my transition was very new. I come from a generation where the sexual revolution had not only been just annihilated, but then had been freed by us. So the debate, a lot of me feels like it's about time. The dialogue, which is very different than debate, is a miracle, and something I never thought would be true, ever, in my life.
Well, what does the success of this show tell you about where this culture is headed in terms of its...
That we're changing. We're moving. But you see, I've always known that. Queer people, art is queer. It's ours. It belongs to us. We breathed life into it. It belongs to us. That's been true throughout history, that art is ours. So the fact of it makes perfect sense to me, because it's us.
That was Alexandra Billings, who plays Davina on the Amazon series Transparent, Trace Lizette, who plays Shay, and Jill Soloway, who created the series. The fourth season of Transparent premieres today on Amazon. That's our show for today. Transparent has changed a lot of people's perspectives, and we want to hear what TV shows have changed the way you think. You can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.